Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Hello there, everybody. It's the last weekend of June. We are peak summer and it's warm at last. Welcome to the podcast. Follow us on Spotify for this weekly selection of our favourite chats from the last couple of days. On this week's episode, we hear the virtues of the banjo with Enda Scal, who is really rather good at plucking the plucky thing. We have a very important conversation with Social Democrats TD about the way we drink in Ireland. Galway legend Joe Canning tells us about his career and why Limerick fans keep thanking him for missing a free and what he feels about that. And Jennifer Zamparelli told us what jobs she will and won't be applying for. So into the podcast we go, and we'll talk on the other side. And you're welcome back. 0870 32 32 32 is the WhatsApp. Now, you do need cheering up, don't you? It's the life and soul of a party at a hoedown, with a twang in its step and a bounce in its strings. And the man with the banjo is Enda Scahill. Good morning, Enda.
Good morning, Oliver.
Enda, by the way, to tell people, he's the founder of We Banjo 3. You are the only Irish act to get to number one on the US Billboard Bluegrass Music Charts 4 times.
Correct, yeah.
That's an extraordinary achievement.
Yeah. We had a great career in the States. Yeah.
You're a very serious banjo outfit.
Yeah, we started as 3 banjos, hence the name, but expanded quickly.
And have you won a Steve Martin Award or something like that?
Yeah, 2022, the Steve Martin Banjo Award.
Which is very coveted because, of course, Steve Martin is a very renowned banjo player.
Yeah, well, a very famous actor. Most people don't know that he plays the banjo, but he's actually a really good player.
When I was reading that over the weekend, because you're coming in, I was like, oh, that's very familiar. I definitely have seen him with a banjo.
Mm-hmm.
At his live comedy, he brings it out, doesn't he?
He does the whole, the Kermit the Frog routine as well. And yeah.
Now, the American banjo and the banjo you have on your lap this morning, they're different machines.
Fundamentally,
okay.
Yes. So the one that Steve Martin plays, or what we'd know as the American bluegrass banjo, has 5 strings tuned completely differently to what I play, which is an Irish banjo.
Yeah.
So an Irish banjo is tuned like a fiddle or like a mandolin, and it's played with one single pick, whereas the 5-string banjo is played with 3 finger picks. So it's like completely different.
Completely different, but it's always a finger pick.
With
strumming with your fingernail.
That's another type of banjo.
Oh, right. I didn't realise banjos were this complicated, but they are.
Yeah, so if you imagine this is the Irish banjo, 4 strings, then you got the bluegrass banjo, which is what Steve Martin plays. And so we'd associate that with like the Beverly Hillbillies and the music from Deliverance. But there's an older type of banjo, which is called a clawhammer banjo.
Right.
And that's the one that's played with fingers.
That's the one that's playing. And Steve Martin is an expert on
He does that as well. Rhiannon Giddens is probably the most famous currently and the biggest proponent of that old style, kind of old time and minstrel banjo.
And she brought that to Beyonce's country and western album, didn't she?
Yeah.
Well, tell us about the instrument, because the neck, is that the correct thing to
that
say
is,
about
yeah.
It's longer on the American one, but you've got your Irish tenor banjo.
So I've got two with me today. So this one over here, this is an Irish banjo. So it's made by Clarine Banjos in Galway. So the standard is 19 fret. So
the frets are the metal strips on the neck.
Yes. Yeah. So this would be what would be known as a standard Irish banjo. So it's 19 frets, lots of metal, usually made from mahogany or bird's eye maple. So a hard wood.
Bird's eye maple, that's another American wood, is it?
Is it
do they grow here?
I don't know. I never heard of a bird's eye maple in Ireland.
But it has to be a hardwood.
A hardwood, because there's so much sustain and resonance that needs to happen. So when you play the strings, the music goes through the bridge onto the head, which is like the skin or the vellum. And then that's shot into the back of the banjo and then projected back out. But it needs to vibrate through the neck.
Right? That's very important.
So if you have a soft wood, it won't vibrate properly. And so you won't get any sound.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
You were telling me some lovely words associated with the actual the biology of the banjo, if I can say it.
I used to be terrible at remembering where all the different parts are.
We can't see the pot.
No. So the pot is like the round wooden, it's also known as the rim.
Yeah.
So it's the round wooden bit that's inside the banjo. And on top of that sits a metal hoop, which is called the tone ring. We won't get into technicalities and tonelings with this.
Don't be apologising. We love the technicalities.
Well, there's a couple of different types. But yeah. Interestingly, Irish banjos have an arch top tone ring, which means that the amount of the head that reverberates is smaller than on a bluegrass banjo. They have what's known as a flat top.
Right.
And it just gives more sustain. It gives the Irish banjo the brightness.
I get you. Yeah.
That's different to you'd hear on an American banjo.
It's a pluckier fella, basically, is it?
Yeah.
Or girl.
Lots of bing and not as much bong. Yeah.
There's a pot on a flange you had mentioned earlier on.
Yeah, so if you're looking straight at it, you got the head, which is the skin part. It used to be an animal skin.
Oh,
so
and not any longer.
No. Well, you still can get animal heads.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so you can get like calfskin vellum for banjos.
Go away.
So some people would use that. On my other banjo here, I have fibre skin, so it's a kind of a synthetic skin look.
Okay. Lasts longer, I presume.
I've never used one with an animal head on it.
Yeah. I would have thought now.
I know. So the fancy bit then on the outside is called the flange.
Right.
Which is mostly decoration. So back in the day when they were making these. So the Irish banjo is an adaptation of what was a jazz banjo.
Okay.
So what would have been used one time, and I don't play, it's about the only type of banjo that I don't play, which would be like the Dixieland. Those banjos were those banjos were very flamboyant.
Yeah.
So there was loads of inlay and everything was covered in gold and some of them had like diamante, you know, edges and the whole lot. So that's why the outside bit is called the flange.
Very good. Pure decoration. Well, it's very pretty. It makes
pure,
it look...
Yeah. Now, thankfully, the more modern banjos are more function than form, so they sound great without all of the bling and the razzmatazz. But
the banjo's gone on a mad journey around the world, hasn't it? Which we'll come to, quite a literal physical journey.
Yeah.
Our first song is Man of Constant Sorrow, which people will know from the Oh Brother Where Art Thou kind of made it famous. But it's around a long time, I presume, that tune.
Well, you see, this is the movie that kind of started the last 25 years of a huge interest in bluegrass and old-time music.
It really did have that impact.
Huge, yeah. Wow. So a lot of people would say that the likes of Mumford & Sons and, you know, even the big rush we've seen in country music can be traced back to the interest that people had in that particular film. Wow. And the most well-known song on it was Man of Constant Sorrow. So people will know the basic melody, which is like... So on a four-string banjo, which I play, we have to kind of dress it up a little bit.
Oh, I see.
So that's just filling in all the gaps.
You make me want to watch that film again, or go to a show either. It would make more sense, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
George Clooney's in and Coen Brothers.
That's right.
Directed it, so it had that impact.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is
quite
extraordinary.
Huge impact. Yeah.
The history of the banjo is fascinating because normally we're talking about, you know, Irish instruments that go to America and then join bluegrass, but this movement comes from the continent down in the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah, the banjo's from West Africa. And interestingly, that movie kind of places the banjo in this whole very much white America.
Yeah.
You know, and this is work that's been done massively by Rhiannon Giddens over the last kind of 10 or 15 years. But the basic story is that when enslaved Africans were brought to the West Indies and eventually to America, they brought the instrument with them. So the original definition of a banjo is a gourd, so like a dried out vegetable with an animal skin.
Really?
A neck made from wood. And then strings on a bridge. So that's what differentiates it from like a guitar or other stringed instruments, that it's very specifically that design. Now, all we have today is very modernized with modern materials. Mm-hmm. But and there's an awful lot been written. There's a wonderful book called Well of Souls, Uncovering the Hidden History of the Banjo. And that like goes into great detail into the old stories and the culture and how important that banjo was to the enslaved Africans when they were in America. Mm-hmm. And it was such a huge part of all of their rituals. And it kind of got written out of black history.
Yeah.
And because when people think of the banjo, they immediately think, That's that American instrument.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's very, very predominantly a white instrument because of bluegrass music, which was started in Kentucky. And so a lot of the work Rhiannon has been doing is just like reclaiming a lot of the black history of the instrument. That there were some really great players that were like important in the development, taking it from a gourd to what we know today. And our Irish musicians played a huge role in that as well.
Because obviously they didn't commercialise it. There were the enslaved people for centuries, but they kept the instrument going.
Yeah.
And it was adapted. Well, then tell us how the Irish come into this instrument and what influence do we have?
Yeah, so, I mean, at the same time, there's a lot of kind of mixed up history in relation to it. So there was a Professor Mick Maloney from NYU. Mick was an Irish guy. He died a couple of years ago and a great banjo player. But he talked about the Irish indentured workers that were meeting the enslaved Africans.
Yeah.
And all of these people were you know, working on the cotton fields. Mm-hmm. So you had Irish musicians that brought the fiddle with them mm-hmm. and a lot of Scottish musicians as well, meeting these African musicians that were playing banjo. And so you had this kind of amalgamation of the two musical styles. So you hear the rhythm of what the African music was that came into kind of what we now know as old time music. But that was hugely influenced by Irish musicians that were bringing fiddle tunes. So if you think of old time music being very, 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 very rhythmical, it's this kind of... That's what the Africans brought. And then the Irish were playing tunes over the top of it.
Same instrument. It becomes instantly recognisable as Irish trad.
Yeah, yeah.
And they all just join together, don't they? And they all dance together and you create this incredible sound.
It's essentially. Now, the first commercialisation of that music were the minstrels. Now, that was the Blackface Minstrels and they toured all over the world. And there was an Irish guy. They reckon that 80% of the minstrels were Irish musicians.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that bit of it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating history.
Problematic history too, isn't it? Because they were predominantly white.
Well, you see, in a modern context, when you look back at it, you would say, like, it's abhorrent. They stole the music from the Africans and they wore blackface and then they commercialised it. Mm-hmm. They became famous and it was the Irish. You know, and in a modern context, we wouldn't do that. But to look back at it through the lens of history, you'll say it was of its time and they did popularise the music, you know.
And commercialised it, which is...
And commercialised it, yeah.
So what happens? The banjo then, does it come back to Ireland and takes a different form?
Well, the first time it appears in Ireland, they reckon, was in the 1840s. So there was an Irish guy called Dan Emmett and he had a band called the Virginia Minstrels and they travelled all over the world. Now, during that period of time when the minstrels were going all over the world, it popped up in Ireland, they reckon, around the 1840s. So that's the first kind of recorded incidence of the instrument in Ireland. But in terms of it being adapted into Irish music, that's yet another kind of travel, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, Irish music really up in the late 1800s, in the even the early 1900s, it was peasant music. It was completely disregarded by the upper echelons of Irish society. It was music for dancing. And the Irish music that we know now today, reels and jigs and all that, that was only for dancing. It wasn't even really a performance music itself. It served a purpose.
Yeah.
So then you had this wave of immigration from Ireland in the 1800s and the 1900s. And curiously, the first time that Irish music becomes like a true commercial music is in New York, in the early 1900s, in the roaring 20s, and you had a family of brothers from Waterford City called the Flanagan Brothers.
Yeah.
They travel over and they start recording all of these wax cylinder recordings and eventually, you know, records and stuff, and became hugely famous and really, really influential. So that music is then sent back to Ireland, where Irish people are like, you know, just playing in, you know, houses and at the crossroad dances and stuff. And they're like, wow, this is like amazing commercialization of it. So it just raised the whole standard of what Irish music could be.
I see. You're a big fan of the Flanagan Brothers.
Well, Mike Flanagan was the main proponent of Irish banjo. Like one of the really first guys. There was a guy called Eddie Wheeler who wasn't as well known as the Flanagan Brothers.
Will we hear one of those songs? The Jolly Beggarman is a Mike Flanagan, I think,
yeah,
isn't it?
So Mike was the banjo player. They say you spend half your life tuning the banjo and half your life playing out a tune. So, yeah, this is the Jolly Beggarman, right? That everybody will know as the Owl Rigadoo.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm.
we're straight into Irish there, aren't we? That is like very distinct.
100% Irish. Now, the interesting thing about that tune is that it's also now a really famous bluegrass reel.
Oh, right.
But it doesn't have the same name. So it's not known as the Jolly Ragamuffin. They call it the Red-Haired Boy.
Okay, right.
And so in Ireland, it has that kind of bouncy, because it's a song and it has words.
Yeah.
Owl rigadoo, right? Okay. Not a singer, not going to attempt
it. And Flanagan wrote that, Mike Flanagan.
No, this is a really old Irish song. But they popularized it and recorded it.
Very good.
But then the bluegrass musicians took it on. And one of the most famous bluegrass musicians is a guy called Tony Rice. And he would play this like super, super fast, because bluegrass music is like crazy fast.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like...
It's amazing. So, that'll put a smile on your face. But it's still very distinctly Irish in there, isn't it?
Yeah. So very same tune, but just two different treatments of it.
Since we were talking about Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, people are texting in about movies. Well, actually, this one first about Steve Martin. There is a story that apparently he turned up unexpected one day at the Cobblestone in Dublin and joined in a session, says Joe. Music begins and ends in the Cobblestone. There's always nothing ever planned happens there. It's always a surprise. But talking about movies, what about the Deliverance banjo, the famous dueling banjos scene?
It put banjo on the map.
This is going back. I can't remember. The Deliverance must be the 70s or early 80s.
Yeah, 1972, I believe.
As far back as that, more than 50 years. And this is where the city slickers are kind of meeting the rural. And it's a kind of a happy scene, but there's a foreshadowing of the dark themes in the film that are to come.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I don't know if you can do that with one, because you don't have the dueling aspect here.
Yeah, and so this is interesting as well, because this is very much where Irish banjo, you know, sits at home and the bluegrass banjo takes off. So everybody knows... Right?
Yeah.
And we can all play that, because that's dead easy, right?
Is it? Okay. Take your word for it.
Right. Now, this is every Irish banjo player's worst nightmare is like, hey, do you know Deliverance? Right? And it's like, I know that bit, right? Because that bit's easy. And then after that, it goes into the... which is like crazy fast. And that's the three finger picking style that was popularized in Kentucky in 1932. Right? Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys started bluegrass music essentially with this one band. So that's a completely different... picking pattern, so everybody can do that. And it's amazing, like it's the 1970s. If you do that anywhere, basically people go, oh, Deliverance. That's just two chords. And then we're lost, right?
But like a fair juice to you on a four string, because it's obviously they've got the five strings, American style in the film.
Yeah.
And so
absolutely iconic piece of music.
It is.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
But it's a nightmare. I'm sure in a banjo shop, it's even worse.
It's the Stairway to Heaven of banjos.
While we're on the subject of the shop, are banjos an expensive instrument?
They range, but yes. Yeah. Yeah. So a really good banjo is going to start 4,000 or 5,000. Euro.
Really?
Yeah.
But that's the one you'd be getting at an advanced stage.
Yeah.
When you're good.
Yeah. You can get going on a 500 or 600 euro instrument.
Okay.
And again, clarion banjos, like they're made in Ireland, they're made down in Galway. And so their beginner banjos start at 600-700 euro. Their first handmade, like bespoke instruments are about 1,200 or 1,300, which is not a huge amount these days.
But I'm surprised to hear they're made in Ireland. That's a kind of a...
Yeah,
nice aspect to it.
Yeah.
You're a Galway man.
Yeah, Tom has been making banjos for me since I'm like 12 years old, I think.
Were you playing another instrument before the banjo?
Tin whistle, like everybody went into school and got handed a tin whistle, yeah. But I don't even know why I loved the banjo. But we had a music teacher from Mayo called Bernie Gersey. She walked into the school one day, and I distinctly remember. She goes, hands up, who wants to play the banjo? And so I stuck up my hand.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
What was it? There must have been something in your
life. I think it's just the tone. I think it's the sound that's from the instrument. And, you know, they say you can't play sad music on a banjo.
The ornamentation is the big thing for the Irish style, isn't it?
Yes.
That's probably what tickled your fancy.
Well, if you want to impress a bluegrass musician because you can't play as fast as them, you just do some triplets. So that's single pick, and it's just doing...
Oh my God.
Yeah, top question.
That'll blow them away.
Well, every banjo player or banjo student is like, how do I do the triplets?
They want to go straight there.
Yeah, it's the main question I get. I'm constantly getting stuck on my triplets.
That takes a long time.
It's a factor of having good fundamental technique, and the pick hold is very important. So banjo is a very technical instrument. It looks easy, and I guess because it's so old, it's like, banjo, you know. You have to get the fundamental techniques right. And then there's a lot of relaxing and breathing and stuff that's involved as well to reduce tension.
Well, it's because you're, as a texter says, you're an extraordinarily talented banjo player. World class. We're lucky to see him at Galway Sessions from time to time. Great to hear the history of the banjo, says Jerry Hanley in Salt Hill.
Oh, Jerry, well.
Familiar with banjos down there. But it is that ornamentation, isn't it, that... The shared songs as well between them. You have another example, the temperance reel.
Yeah, so this would be...
You'll hear that on both sides of the Atlantic.
Yeah. You know, if you're ever in a bluegrass or old-time session and you're Irish and they say, play a tune that we can all play, there's probably 10 or 15 tunes that are exactly the same.
Okay, with different names.
Yeah. So in Ireland, we'd know this as the teetotaler. And they call it the temperance.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Teetotaler.
The teetotaler.
That's why it's so steady. Can't be played in a drunken way whatsoever. There's a text. It's an important question for you. Can you ask Enda his thoughts on Barney McKenna, the godfather of the traditional banjo?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, we had the Flanagan brothers in the 20s. And then there's essentially a gap up until the 1960s when we had the folk revival. And that's when Clannad, the Chieftains and the Dubliners just made Irish music hugely popular here and abroad. And Barney McKenna was the banjo player with the Dubliners and reportedly the first man to tune it like a fiddle.
Really?
Yeah. So like to get super technical, the Flanagan brothers tuned it like a jazz banjo. So they were tuned a fifth higher than Irish banjo.
Right.
So Barney then tuned it like a fiddle and made it really, really, really popular, really famous. And everybody since then has been playing Irish banjo in this Irish tuning, which is the same as fiddle tuning.
He was that seminal an artist.
Yeah, yeah.
That it's,
and he was a really, really good player, like technically good player. Mm. You know, a lot of what the Dubliners did were songs, and it was, you know, it wasn't as many kind of jigs and reels and, you know, kind of hardcore trad as what we're playing these days. But Barney was a really great player, as was his brother.
Really?
Yeah.
What was his name?
I can't remember.
Is there a defining tune? The McKenna brothers, as we now credit them.
The most famous, one of the most famous tunes. Well, there's two, actually.
All right.
But I think the one that everybody recognises would be the Rocky Road to Dublin.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is a song, which I'm not going to sing, but I'll play it for you.
Like
great piece of music.
Wow.
Yeah. Great piece of music.
It's very bright, isn't it, the sound?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a very happy sound. I mean, you know,
it's very happy.
Like I said, you can't play sad music on a banjo. So I think that's why people are so attracted to the instrument.
You must have had that in your head when you were when you volunteered to be the a banjo player as the kid.
I think so. Yeah, yeah. I love the energy of it, and I also really feel that there's that rebellious kind of spirit that's in it. You know, there's a spirit of survival within the instrument. If you think about Bela Fleck, who's like the most famous banjo player, he's won 17 Grammys in the States. He's an absolute genius. He made a documentary called Throw Down Your Heart. And it's a kind of a sad title because when the slavers were bringing Africans to the West Indies, they would say, throw down your heart, as in leave your heart here in Africa because you're, you know.
That's what the phrase was.
But they realized that if they brought a banjo on board, way more of the slaves survived the journey.
Wow.
You know, so, and then this book that Christina Gaddi wrote is all about this resurgent spirit that, that people have that's deeply rooted in music.
There's a hope and optimism in it.
Absolutely.
That's and why it lifts your day on a particular day
like today. Yeah, I'm just a firm believer that that energy is just still in the instrument all like hundreds of years later.
Did you tell us what the other defining tune of Barney McKenna's was? Because you mentioned the Rocky Road.
He played Chief O'Neill's.
Chief O'Neill's, you said. I was hypnotised. Someone bringing a bottle of stout, warm, off the shelf. Loads of texts are flying in. Enda Scahill. Talent is just another word for the love of a thing. And you're very generous, by the way. You're playing way more than we've liked to do. Thanks so much. He's doing a lot of this off the cuff. That's from Tara in Dublin, which is a lovely way of putting it. Totally loving your speaker on the banjo. This is Enda Scahill. Great news to all the banjo teachers in the country. My daughter's learning here in Clare. Didn't know much of the history of it. That's from June in Kilrush, County Clare. A lot of banjos around Kildare, around Clare.
Loads of banjos all over the country. It's hugely popular.
Is it a good instrument for kids to start out on, or do they need the tin whistle first and into the banjo?
I would say tin whistle first. It's a big instrument and you can't see both your hands at the same time. Right? Which you wouldn't think about.
No,
right? You might, you know, if you're playing, like you can look down at your tin whistle.
Of course,
and you can see.
Yeah.
So you need to be physically able to hold it and not have it sliding off your lap. So I generally say around 8 or 9 is the earliest. I've tried to teach a 6-year-old one time and it was hysterical because they literally, like the right hand will do one thing and I'll say, now put your left hand on the strings and the right hand will go away because
okay.
They can't see the two of them at the same time.
I see, yeah. Yeah. And it's, there's no mini banjo. Would it be connected at all to the ukulele, someone is asking?
I mean, it has 4 strings. And you can play music on it.
Because that would be a nice little instrument for a child, wouldn't it?
We just had that ukulele festival in Galway this weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Hundreds of ukulele players.
I know. And that sounds merry altogether, doesn't it?
Great fun. I mean, if there's no happier instrument than the ukulele. No. Even you know, Trump and the banjo, I think.
Well, the banjo's doing a good it's doing an amazing job. End of the class act, wonderful knowledge of the instrument history and, of course, how to play it, says Pat. I was handed a banjo at the age of 70, 3 years later, enjoying it, from Jimmy Curran in Beaumont.
Yeah, yeah.
In Dublin.
I teach lots of kind of older guys because I think it's a kind of a retirement thing. Loads of guys retire and they certainly did over the last 3 or 4 years, you know. And they go, oh, I always wanted to play the banjo.
What a brilliant idea, though.
Brilliant idea, yeah. So that's what I do now is I create music lessons online. And I've like 700 banjo players around the world that I'm interacting with kind of all of the time.
Have they all come from another instrument or are people coming out of careers and...
Everything. Really? But like some people are literally taking it up for the first time.
Well, go away.
You know, they say, oh, I always wanted to play the banjo. And so, you know, we start off with Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star and then progress into simple reels and jigs.
As with every instrument, you have to start somewhere, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
IrishBanjoLessons.com.
That's me.
For people jumping in. Yeah. And do you do it online or in person or how do you...
Online.
Online,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Solved everything.
Yeah.
And obviously recommending the local place for the banjos.
Yeah.
And I presume they're rented as well. You can rent, as with all instruments.
I think so, yeah. A lot of places rent them out. And, yeah.
Pat in Dublin says, there's a great banjo riff on Tuesday Morning by The Pogues. The banjo certainly features along there as well. The banjo player, it's a very good banjo player who played on the pier in Dunleary in Dublin. It's lovely to hear a banjo being played, says Jen. That could be anybody. The banjo people are kind of a gorilla around.
Banjo people.
They show up.
That's how we're known.
What is the kind of nerddom that it really attracts super nerds, the banjo?
Yeah,
doesn't
it does,
it?
Yeah.
Different
collectors.
And collectors as well.
Yeah, so there's a banjo museum in Oklahoma. I'm on the wall, but I've never been.
Are you?
Yeah. And so they have hundreds of these incredibly ornate banjos.
Because of your number ones, I presume. Is that why you're on the awards?
It's a record I did in 2006 with a Melodian player that we won. It was Album of the Year in the Irish Times. So that record is on the wall, yeah.
You'll have to go and visit us.
I know, it's on my list of things to do. I haven't played in Oklahoma. It's one of four states that I haven't played in yet.
How many banjos do you own and cherish?
I only have four at the moment.
Do you?
I have had six at various times.
Have you had the four forever?
The one I'm playing at the moment, I got made for me. It's a maker in Oregon. So this is like a hybrid banjo. So it's essentially, now you see, this is where it gets very nerdy. The nerds would say it's a plectrum banjo, but I would say that it's the neck from a five-string banjo put on the posh of a four-string banjo. So it's a hybrid.
Special design. You're calling it the hybrid.
Yeah.
More text. My favourite bit of banjo playing is Sweet 16 by Finbar Fury. Not to forget, yeah. Tommy Makem, says Conniel in Kildare.
This is the most iconic banjo line of all time.
Of course.
I haven't played it in a while.
Sweet 16.
Sweet 16. Finbar, funnily enough, played it on a five-string banjo.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Just wondering if there's anyone in Dublin that can get banjo lessons from a pure beginner. That's from Tony in Beaumont. Many thanks. Well, IrishBanjoLessons.com. You could do it from anywhere in the world, as I'm sure they do with the great Enniscahill. And they're free. They're not free, are they, the banjo lessons? No.
No, well, I just recently published a 9-hour beginner course, which has got like four camera angles.
Oh,
I became a whole tech studio in my house.
So that would be on YouTube, I presume.
So I have a YouTube channel, which is just Enniscahill Irish Banjo and Mandolin, and that's very popular.
And if you want the one-to-one, you go with yourself. But IrishBanjoLessons.com.
That's it.
And there's a new record this Friday called The Dark Well.
Yeah. I sound so hip. It was a harmonica player that I met on Instagram. He's from Sweden. Yeah, Yul Anderson. So we were just chit-chatting on Instagram and I said, we should do a record. And he goes, when will I come over? I was like, come over in January. So we spent 2 days playing. And the reason we called it The Dark Well relates to the banjo. It's an album title.
It's such
a
happy instrument.
You see, a friend of mine in New York came to see us playing and he was like, oh my God. And he was like, so effusive. This is like drinking water from an ancient well. And I went, well, the banjo, we're not allowed in the ancient well. We're over here digging our own well. So,
will we go out on a bit of the rocky road? But Enniscahill, sure. Thank you so much for coming in and chatting through the banjo with us. And good luck with everything you're doing. It's going very well.
Thank you very much.
Email Oliver at rte.ie.
And you're all very welcome. 0870 32 32 32. Yes, that is the WhatsApp. Now, the government has said it might delay mandatory health labelling on alcohol, and it's all to do with Donald Trump's threatened tariffs on Irish exports. I think the deadline for his tariffs decision is the 9th of July. And Ireland actually won praise for research groups, cancer research groups worldwide over the plan. We would be the first country to warn drinkers of the link between cancer and alcohol consumption on labels. It's due to happen from 2026. Now, the Social Democrats TD for Dublin Rathdown, Sinead Gibney, she has objected to any consideration of a delay, and she has said alcohol has had a negative impact on her life. She was speaking in the Dáil last Thursday, so let's have a listen to what she was saying back then first.
Minister, I haven't had a drink of alcohol in 13 and a half years, and alcohol and its negative impacts have played a huge part in my life. And I say this and I share this because I think there is hardly a family in Ireland which doesn't have the same experience.
Very true. Good morning, Sinead Gibney.
Good morning, Oliver.
And when did you decide, or why did you decide to go public on this? It's a personal issue for you.
It is a personal issue. I mean, I've been public before. I spoke about it on a podcast a couple of years ago. I've never kind of kept it a secret necessarily, but I did appreciate, obviously, as a newly elected TD 6 months in, that if I chose to reveal it as a TD, but particularly in the Dáil Chamber, yes, that it would get a bit of attention. So essentially, I kind of used it to draw attention to this issue, because this is a bit of a stealth issue at the moment, that the government are potentially going to claw back on this, and I do want to make sure that they don't. So I essentially figured I might as well get a bit of value out of announcing it.
Okay,
you know?
So it's that personal meeting the political, isn't it? We'll come back to the specific legal issue of that. But when did you stop drinking exactly?
13 and a half years ago, New Year's Eve 2011. I had planned to give up the January after that, but I had a particularly heavy night just before Christmas and decided to give up on New Year's Eve. So yeah, I gave up on New Year's Eve. I was 35 at the time, no, 36 maybe.
Yeah.
So 13 and a half years ago, and it was one of the best decisions of my life.
What was your relationship with the drink before that? Do you remember when you started?
Yeah, like, so I mean, I started when I was a teenager, like most Irish people, and I was somebody who drank heavily, but in a way that I would say is quite normalised in Irish society. Mm-hmm. Like everybody around me drank at the same rate, or maybe I was a little bit better at holding, you know, keeping the course of a night. And that was the thing, was I was good crack. I was always up last one standing, always looking for where we were going to bring the party next. And you know, people said to me when I gave up, you know, but why you? You're such fun, you know.
Really?
But it played a big toll on me. I had really atrocious hangovers, like from, you know, when I was very young, right through to when I gave up. I had
from your twenties, teenage.
Like 20s and 30s in particular, I would say really bad hangovers that would last sometimes a couple of days, you know, and. But more so was the kind of mental health toll, I would say, on me, because often, you know, it would just like the self-loathing that you get, the fear, I used to call it. I'm sure people still do.
Delirium tremens,
you know?
Known.
The flashbacks.
And explain the fear as you experienced it.
Well, it just, I think, self-loathing, and, you know, I'm quite a self-critical person anyway. And if I had a bad hangover, or, you know, or if I'd be, you know, kind of had a big night out, I suppose I would just beat myself up about it a lot and just wouldn't be back to my full self. And that's why I do think of alcohol as a barrier to potential. And I've said this, you know, I think there's a lot of us who can achieve more if we step away from alcohol and really examine our relationship with it. Like I could have continued and functioned, and I'm sure I would have done well in my career and been led a happy life to a degree, but I have found happiness in sobriety that I would never have achieved if I hadn't stepped away from alcohol.
Right.
There's no question.
When you were drinking, did you want to get drunk? Do you remember I want the buzz?
Yes.
Or what was the point?
Yeah, I mean, the buzz, maybe not ever aiming to get drunk, but just have the crack and, you know, be the life and soul of the party and do all the fun things. Like.
And you were known as the crack.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I still am, I suppose, a little bit. Maybe I've got back there. I mean, because it did change how I socialised after I gave up immediately. It definitely, I struggle a lot with how to socialise with people now, because it's really boring being sober in a pub. Like, it's just really boring.
Well, it's not uncommon now, but I'd say when you quit 13 and a half years ago, it was quite rare, wasn't it, to be suddenly not drinking?
Absolutely.
If you were known, and are your friends associated with who you go out with? Does that kind of determine your circle as well?
Yeah, exactly. And like you just, people, it's much more accepted now to do it or to try it, sobriety like. But back then, it was much more of a question of, why are you doing that? And what does that mean to me? Like, I do think there's a mirror you hold up when you give up drinking, which forces people to examine their own drinking, and they don't really like it that much. But if you're in a pub and you're not drinking, like, it's good crack for the first little while, and then it just gets really boring because, like, we're just not as funny as we think we are when we're drinking. I have to say that was one of the first realisations I had. And it's the same joke, and it goes on.
That's a deep revelation, isn't it?
Yeah, sorry, Ireland.
We're not funny after a very, very short while.
It's like, it's the same joke all night, you know, and it's just a
right,
bit like,
yes.
Yeah, like, and also standing up in pubs and shouting and hurting your throat and those kinds of things are just not comfortable when you're not, you know, when you're sober. Like,
now there are people obviously who are listening to you and going, no, I had a great weekend and I remember the fella standing in the pub, or maybe it was that they were the person, and going, she's kind of wrong.
Yeah.
But you see, you're on the other side of it now, aren't you? You're on the sobriety side of the fence.
Yeah.
You remember being messy as a drunk? Do you remember kind of embarrassing incidents that you wish had not occurred?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, and some of them in particular, I raised my daughter alone. And some of the moments as a mom are the ones that particularly kind of stick with me as, right. as moments of regret, I would say, you know, when I just didn't, you know, meet my own standards, I suppose, as a mom.
Do you remember particular incidents? I don't want you to revisit things that are...
No, that's okay. I don't mind. No. Like, just, I suppose, you know, like there's one event, and I actually don't even remember the details of where it was. I just remember the feeling afterwards of my daughter fell, and I was with a big crew. And because I had had my daughter so young, like she was the only kid for quite a while, or, you know, one of the only kids. And anyway, she fell, and I just didn't go to her in the way. I kind of like dismissed it, and she was fine, but it was a bad enough fall that I should have examined it, and I should have been right at her side immediately.
Was this at a party or something?
Yeah. I honestly don't even remember what it was. It was like just a birthday party or something with a big group of friends. It was a daytime. That's all I remember. Like,
and maybe you were kind of thinking, I don't want to go home from the party.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody else will get her. She's great.
So we were being hard on yourself anyway while continuing the drinking. Yeah. I'm curious as well. You're a single mum. Obviously, in the early years, you mustn't have been drinking very much.
As a single mum?
Yeah.
No, it didn't really stop me, to be honest. Like, so I was 23 when I got pregnant, and it was a crisis pregnancy, and I was 24 when I had my daughter. I lived with my parents, so I was back into my childhood room for the first 4 years of Bella's life with her in the room with me. And, you know, being a single mum in your parents' house, and my grandmother lived with us at the time, we'd four generations, and, you know, there's a lot of, you know, benefit to having live-in babysitters. It's great. Mm-hmm. It's also quite tough because it's quite hard to be your own parent, as you know, do your own parenting style when you've got your mum kind of telling you how she would do it. And of course, she was much easier on Bella than she would have been on us, you know. But I have a very close relationship. My dad died last year, but I've had a very close relationship. Thank you. Yeah, with my parents, and I described us as a parenting team, you know. But I kind of didn't let becoming a mum get in the way of my social life, and I'm sure part of that was because of my relationship and my addictive relationship with alcohol, there's no doubt.
It sounds like it was a very happy house.
Yeah, it was. I mean, absolutely.
So you weren't escaping any pain, you don't think?
No, God, no. No, I had a really happy childhood. And, you know, my mum was giving out to me yesterday for, she's like, you know, I didn't know you started drinking at 14. She read it in the paper over the weekend. So it's like, well, you know, it wasn't that.
Was she shocked by that?
No. I think she was just covering her ass. but no, it was a very happy household, very supportive household. My parents are, you know, have been wonderful in my life. And so, no, it wasn't. It wasn't like alcohol was not, you know, it wasn't filling any kind of trauma or anything. But it was definitely a crutch, like it is for so many Irish people, and a crutch in social situations in particular.
OK, so you make this big decision. It's New Year's Eve, 13 and a half years ago. Congratulations. Yeah. Completely sober since then.
Yeah. And I didn't plan to be at the time. I was said to myself, I'll give up for 18 months. And I was doing a master's at the time, and I had 18 months left of it. So I was working in a big job at the time in Google. I was doing that master's, and I was a single mum, and I just felt like I just wanted to try my life without alcohol. I just wanted to see what it was like. And I had my cousin is Des Bishop, the comedian, and he's obviously had his own sobriety journey. And he was a great influence, I have to say, at the time, and just kind of helped me to just examine it and question it and see what it would be like. And 18 months for me felt like a good time because it was going to give me one of everything, you know, a Christmas, a holiday, a date, whatever, you know, all of those different things to try sober.
And it wasn't like an endless cliff that you were suddenly looking at. You had a target.
Yeah, but it's long enough. See, I think, you know, like people will do Dry January or they might do a 3 month stint. And I do think sometimes when people try sobriety in those instances, they kind of are just waiting until, like, they know, you know, that kind
they
of
might
next
make up for it as well.
Yeah, a little bit maybe, but you have insight the next time you're going to drink. Whereas I think if you really do want to try and see what it's like to be sober, you got to give up for a decent amount of time.
A year and a half. And did you get particular therapy, or did you go into a group? Or
I did. Yeah, I got great therapy from a brilliant therapist. Stephen Roan is his name, and he previously worked in the Rutland, so he had addiction as a speciality.
Yeah.
Although I feel like it wasn't necessarily addiction that I dealt with him. You know, we. Like, and I've had therapy in and out of my life. I'm very open about that, and I love therapy. And, you know, it threw up You know, in addiction and recovery, people say that when you take away the painkiller, you feel the pain. And when you stop drinking alcohol, you do deal with issues in your life that you don't otherwise deal with. There's no question.
Really?
And so he helped me navigate that, essentially. And there was stuff that I had to kind of work through with him. And then a few years later, I did try AA and I really enjoyed it. I found a lovely community there and a really nice meeting. You know, there's very different types of meetings, but this particular one had a lot of people who kind of were well into their journey of sobriety. And it was just, it's amazing to hear people speak your experience when you're in those rooms.
And this, it's funny, it was a couple of years into your sobriety, you decided to go to AA.
Yeah.
Did you call yourself an alcoholic at that point, although you were now completely sober?
I've never really kind of embraced the word. I suppose in the last few days I have more than, I have now that it's quite this public. And I've not, it's not that I've any shame or, you know, or association with the word. It just, I never have really. I mean, I've talked more, I suppose I use the language of addiction and recovery more than I do alcoholism, I guess. I don't know why. But in those rooms, I learned a lot about it. You really do understand addiction more when you're surrounded by people who have that experience.
Right.
So I found it a great solace. I just, at the time, I was particularly skint. I couldn't afford therapy, so AA was great.
Is that free?
It's AA is free, okay. And you just rock up, and there's very different types of meetings. You know, some of them might be for people, or it might have people there who are, you know, just more recently given up. And I found those meetings a little bit tough because they're, you know, it's just tough listening to people's very kind of now experience, whereas people who've traversed the journey and have something to say about it, I found very, very lovely. And a lovely feature of AA, which I quite took me by surprise, was how caring and nurturing it is and how lovely it is to see men openly caring and affectionate with each other. You don't see it very often, and maybe a bit more now, 10 years on. But
because they're healing.
Yeah.
So that worked for you. How good has life been then as sober Sinead Gibney?
It's been great. I think definitely there are, I would question that I am where I am today if I hadn't have done it. I mean, I've had I think so. Like, I think, like, it just has improved me as a person in terms of my own knowing myself, accepting myself, and growing as a person. So obviously I've taken big leaps in my career and you know, who knows, maybe I would have done it anyway as a drinker, but I certainly would be a lot more tired.
It doesn't sound like you would have had the energy to do, because you were a Google social lead, was that kind of?
Social Action, head of Social Action, so kind of corporate social responsibility there.
Their dealings with charities.
Exactly, yeah.
Essentially, and then you went from there into politics?
No, from there into the public sector. So I was the inaugural director, and then just more recently I was the chief commissioner of the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission. And then I gave up that role at the beginning of last year to run in the European election.
Yeah.
Didn't win that, and then went for the general, and now I'm a politician.
You didn't win that, and you lost quite a lot of money running for Europe
as well,
didn't you?
Yeah,
your own personal money too.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, and I people might not kind of grasp that, but, like, you know, running a European election is particularly expensive. I mean, the general elections aren't too bad, but a European election, you can spend up to $250,000. Now, we wouldn't have gone anywhere near that as a party. And as a party, they were, you know, the Social Democrats have been incredibly supportive and did fund my campaign as much as they could. But I had to put up some of my own dosh, you know. And
20,000?
Yeah, 20,000, yeah.
Of your money. And you would have got the deposit. You would have got the money back.
I would have, but I just missed out.
440 votes short, which in a big vote like the European elections was hard to take.
Yeah.
Has it all been healed now with the fact that you became a TD a few months later?
Yeah, it definitely was. And my sister said that at the time, like, you got to think about it not as a loss, but as an investment, because there's no question that my campaign for the Europeans helped my campaign for the general. So yeah, it is healed to a degree. But I mean, it's still financially, I'm paying it back. You know?
Still owe the money.
Yeah, exactly.
And does the party not help out in those
cases? Well, no, I mean, the party lost money as well. So,
they paid 25,000.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like, because I think that we took a bit of criticism, or some commentators kind of criticised the party for not supporting me. That's not the case at all.
Like, it is, okay.
As a small party, to run three candidates in the Europe was quite a feat.
And you sold your car to raise the money?
I did indeed, yeah. And I bought a nice car when I got the chief commissioner gig, and I had to sell that, yeah.
Do you have a car now?
I do, yeah.
You have to get around.
Same car, but an earlier model, essentially. Okay. Yeah. It's much cheaper.
How's your relationship with your daughter now?
Yeah, great. Yeah. She's fab. She's 24. She is. She loves music. She started a course and then didn't stick it out. But she's still doing kind of music production herself. She's working in a restaurant at the moment, and she has a lovely partner, Jazz.
And because she was 11, wasn't she, when you gave up? So
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So she was 11. And I was very aware of that at the time. I had read that between 11 and 14, apparently, is where your exposure to what your primary caregiver's relationship is or behaviour is with alcohol is very much going to inform your own drinking later in life. So I was really conscious of that as a heavy drinker and a single mum. Like, and it's a very intense relationship, you know, as a one parent, one child, I think, anyway. And so I was quite conscious of giving up and talking to her about it as I did that, which I did. And she was very supportive of me, I have to say, you know. And yeah, we've a good relationship. She's tested it. I've tested it, I'm sure, over the years, yeah. As you do.
And she's in that lovely young generation, both Belle and Jazz, aren't they? They're drinking far less.
Yeah.
And it's not necessary for the crack at all.
Yeah, totally. And it's quite cool to, you know, talk about drinking and be aware of it. And I think, like, if there's anything I do, I realise I have a platform now, and that's why I want to talk about this, because I do think we all should simply examine our relationship with alcohol. I think a lot of us would benefit if we were more honest about, you know, what it does for us and you know.
And you think it would be really important to have those labels, which have been in train,
yes,
now for 3 years, haven't they?
Well, more than that. The legislation was passed in 2018, and from 2023, the timeline was essentially set in legal terms. So by May 2026, they have to be on bottles or on alcohol products. And, you know, the response I got from the Minister for Enterprise or his team, it was one of the junior ministers who responded to me, you know, was essentially, this is for health. But there's no question that they, as a department, and both the Minister for Finance and the Taoiseach have also publicly said that, yeah, they think it should be paused. But it's a red
Simon
herring.
Simon Harris, yeah, says it could be delayed due to economic uncertainty. And the Minister of Enterprise, Peter Burke, and the Junior Minister, Alan Dillon, are saying the government's considering pausing the label because of the threat to Irish exports.
Yeah, and I think, like, it's very confusing for people because the labels are not for exports. They're for domestic products.
It just has to follow the law in Ireland.
Say again?
It just has to follow the law in Ireland. So if you're sending a bottle of whiskey or a bottle of wine to America, the labels won't be on them.
No, exactly. So all they're saying is that it's a tough time for drinks manufacturers. We're going to throw them a bone on this, which I think is ridiculous. Like, it's they're not connected. And, you know, it is just the cost of the state of alcohol is 12 billion a year in terms of justice, health and productivity loss. Like, there's so much more to gain from introducing these labels. I appreciate that the drinks industry is in a tough place with tariffs, and we as a state and the government needs to support them in pivoting to markets and in looking at supply chains, all of those different things that we need to do in the context of the tariff war. But hands off the labelling. It's too important.
It's interesting because only yesterday there was alcohol action groups in the UK,
yes,
are lobbying,
right,
to do,
yeah,
the same thing. And
yeah, exactly.
Although they're not pointing to us, we would be the first country in the world to do that.
Yeah, I mean, some countries have some labels, but these would be, like, they're very small label, and they say they make the connection between alcohol and liver disease, cancers and drinking during pregnancy. And so they would be the best in class, if you like. And, you know, and the other thing is, like, for imports, like, there's some people who are importing into Ireland already, some distributors,
yeah,
and manufacturers,
see it, yeah,
already. Yeah,
we,
so you can see them
see
in
the pregnant
your
woman,
yeah,
label in particular, don't
that's
you?
That's it. That's the one, like. And so, and the other thing is, even for Irish manufacturers, even if they don't do it, like, the legal obligation sits at the point of retail. So if they don't have the means to change their labelling between now and next May, somebody's just going to slap it on for them. Do you know what I mean? So
yes,
it really,
yes,
is,
okay,
I think, such a...
And in fact, if you go into an off-licence today, you will see some of the labels, yeah, already in place in anticipation, yeah, of this legislation, because
exactly,
wine has to be made or labelled ahead of time and so on.
Yeah.
There are lots of messages which we'll hope to come to before the end of the show. But in the meantime, Sinead Gibney, thanks a million for sharing your story and happy sobriety. You're still the crack.
Yeah, thanks,
you
Oliver.
Might just leave
thank
a bit
you
early. Is that the
exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you so much.
But good luck with everything and good luck with the debt as well.
Cheers.
Thanks
thank
so much.
You.
Bye-bye.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Now at the back, 0870 32 32 32, that's the WhatsApp. Joe Canning is one of hurling's greatest ever players. Paula Flynn's Naughty Sports journalist, who's turned Joe's story into a book for children. And he doesn't sanitise the story at all. The it's all in there. The violence of a county final, the winning, the fury, the sadness, victory, of course, quite a few of those, and a famous silage pit. It's called Joe the Great. Paul is here, and so too is the five-time All-Star winner, Joe Canning. Good morning to you both.
Morning, Oliver. How are you?
Are you friends now after doing this book? Are you best
friends? Yeah.
We're still talking anyway, yeah.
We're here, aren't we?
You insisted on the title, I take it, Joe.
Yeah, I came up with it. Yeah. There was only one title and that was it.
Come here, does 2017, is that still a thing you wake up every morning thinking about and go, that was all worth it?
Yeah, it was brilliant. It's so long ago now, like, it's a bit crazy. The years just fly by. People still kind of bring it up every now and again, but you're almost like, when's the next kind of victory going to go? But unfortunately in Galway the last weekend, it wasn't great, but
we'll come to that in a minute.
We'll come to that, yeah.
Do people say lovely things still, but when they come up to you, what do they say to you?
Yeah, they do, most people do anyway. If you're, well, apart from if you're from Waterford or maybe Tipperary or something, they don't really, but...
That's the sad thing about that day, wasn't it? Because it was going to be historic either way.
It was historic either way, yeah. And you kind of... It was one of those finals where I'm supposed probably the neutral probably didn't mind who won. But in some ways, obviously Galway wanted Galway and Waterford wanted Waterford. But luckily enough, it was in our favour for once.
Now, people also mentioned the 2018 final to you. Yeah. Because you live in Limerick.
Yeah.
And that was the start of kind of Limerick's...
Yeah, a lot of people thanked me for missing a free. That's how they kind of approach me in Limerick now. Thanks for missing that free. And you're kind of going like, in your own mind, you're like... You know, you don't want to see... Yeah, you want to say something
different. Does it tick you off?
It at this stage you're kind of just laugh it off, but
not really.
Yeah, it's always one of those things that if I'd one moment back in my career to just take something, that's probably it. I'd love to take that free again and score it.
But surely you dwell on the good bit, which is the victory the year before.
Yeah, but I think that's probably the competitive nature of sports people. You kind of more dwell on things that probably didn't go well, and see how you can improve on that and how you look back. Jesus, if I'd only done this or only done that, maybe we might have been more successful. But that's, I think, the competitive nature of sports people. They always look at maybe some of the bad things and reflect on how can I get better.
Paul Flynn, he's not over it.
No, I think that's the fascinating thing about these top sports stars, that's exactly how he got. They're all driven and all their minds are that they don't dwell on the success for too long. And I think for me, that was the fascinating thing about Joe's story for kids, you know, is that struggle, I suppose, really, to get over the line. And he's born with all the talent in the world from a great hurling family and had so much underage success. But then... it doesn't go exactly as you might have mapped it out from a young age. And I think the message of the book, really, if there is one for kids, is that to keep going, keep banging on the door, keep showing up. And, you know, no matter how talented you are, you have to do the work. You have to persist and you have to keep going. And I think Joe would probably prefer it was the other way around to make a little bit light of it. Joe won't thank me for saying this, but King Henry, which was the other book I wrote about, Henry Sheffield.
It was a lot easier, right?
Henry was born, was brilliant hurling and won everything all the way through. Yeah. And when I finished the book, I sent it in to the publishers, and the editor sent it back and said, there's not enough struggle here, you know. So I had to go back for Henry and kind of create a little bit of struggle. But Joe, unfortunately for Joe,
it was an easy sell.
For me,
was there any struggle?
The struggle was,
King Henry,
the struggle was there. Yeah, the struggle was there. But I think it culminates in that win in 2017. And I think as a natural story, it was just so brilliant. And I think when Joe said the neutrals, and I know people from Waterford might disagree, but I think a lot of people in the country really wanted Joe to win that All-Ireland, because I think that tag of the greatest player never to win an All-Ireland would have been such a monkey on his back, you know.
That would have been worse than missing that for you.
Yeah, for sure. Is Patrick Horgan the greatest player who hasn't won an All-Ireland, and could it happen?
Personally, I hope it happens for him, because it's not it can't be easy. People with that tag isn't a nice tag, but there's loads of there's loads of players down through the years that haven't won All-Irelands, and I think it's an unfair kind of I've always said it, if he was playing an individual sport, fair enough, but great players like Ken McGrath, Dan Shanahan, John Milan, loads of lads in Galway that haven't won All-Irelands, that just because maybe they weren't lucky enough to be on a team on a certain year, good enough to win, or lucky enough to win in some cases, it doesn't make them out to be any less of a hurler, in my opinion.
Yeah, but the tag is...
It's an easy tag.
It sounds like a failure, doesn't it?
It sounds like it, but hopefully they're looking good. this year so far, but obviously Dublin will have something to say about it in a few next week. And obviously Kilkenny and Tip on the other side, it opens it up, especially with Limerick kind of gone and people's favourites and stuff like that.
But since we're on it and you're a pundit, do you know which of the four?
Honestly, I think if I had 20 quid now, I'd put it on Kilkenny.
Oh, would you?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I just think to say Cork, actually.
Yeah, no. And then everybody thinks Cork, and fair enough, yes, they are the form team, but
it's 20 years.
How could you back
since
Kilkenny?
Kilkenny's 10 years since Kilkenny won.
Yeah,
which
is
remarkable as well, isn't it?
When you talk about Henry, they have the history, they have the success. Obviously, Cork have it as well, but this team are around a while now. This Kilkenny team, and there's probably
not as much focus on them either, is there?
No,
so much pressure.
And that's the danger. They're coming in a little bit under the radar, so that's always a danger with Kilkenny.
After reading this yesterday, I would kind of get you would hate to see Kilkenny win another one.
No,
because there's
some
of the phrases Paul's put in, where you were sick of the sight of Henry and the black and amber.
But you're always, when there's success for other teams, you always are, and that's part of sport. You're like in whatever sport, it doesn't matter. Man United for years when they were winning soccer, I'm a Liverpool supporter, I used to hate the sight of them as well. And whoever's successful, obviously people, when Limerick are successful, everybody is kind of, when you're on the top, it's only one way down. But at the same time, that's just the beauty of sport and supporting teams.
And obviously Dublin winning would be amazing for the sport.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. It's brilliant for them. And to beat Limerick and have a chance against Cork now in an All-Ireland semi-final, where else would you want to be?
Monster games.
Yeah.
Let's go back to your story. I'm glad Paul O'Flynn, who is not a country fella, has learned what a silage pit is. Although you had to call it a silage mound. I presume that's because you're writing clearly for people. Is that the...
Well, I'm going to defend myself here now. I'd say I spent an awful lot of my youth, actually, in Galway. I have an uncle, Brendan Glynn, who's in Kiltulla, and I spent a lot of summers there. And actually, in the book, there's a line, 1988 was a great year for Galway hurling because Joe Canning was born. But I remember... his father, it was my granddad. He wasn't my granddad, he was my cousin's granddad, but we called him granddad. He was the biggest hurling fan I've ever met in my life. And he used to bring us to Galway train, and we go to Ballinasloe. So I was 7 years old that year, and I remember it. And he'd take the Sacred Heart statue down and stick it in front of the television when he was watching the matches. So I have a good appreciation for the roots of Galway hurling, and I know well what a slurry pit is. Oliver Kellen. Don't assume all us
Do you know he's from Donegal?
Yeah, pure Dublin.
I went to college with him. He mentioned it nearly every day.
He said that. Yeah, he told me on the way in as well. Yeah, we went to college together. Claim to fame.
Damo Dempsey country.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. Very
what's
good.
The hurling? Is there hurling in Donegal or who?
When I played, because I went to school in Raheny, I played with Raheny GA, and we would have had about 40 kids playing. One year when we were under 40, and we had two teams in football, and we had about 12 lads playing hurling. The difference. My dad was from Cork, so I had a good interest in hurling from that, but. It was just the forgotten sport. Nobody wanted to play it, but it's changed in my lifetime. It's fascinating, and to see kids walking around Dublin now with hurls all the time, and it's just amazing. And it was a big shock last week, but I think for the sport in the capital, that's the boost it needs. And to have looks like maybe a sellout this weekend at Croke Park, a huge big All Ireland semi final. I think it's exactly what the sport needs. And it looked like 10 years ago, it looked like they were knocking on the door, and then the success just didn't really quite kick in. Mm-hmm. But at grassroots, you can really see. When I was younger, it was only the kids of parents from the country who played hurling, but now it's a big sport all over.
And of course, the theory is, isn't it, that it's kind of expats of Galway moving into Southside Dublin and Boost and Coola, and then all other clubs all the way through.
Matty Kenny and the likes that was training them. It's brilliant, and they're doing serious work underage. I've come across them, unfortunately, a few years now with 20s, and they've beaten us the last 2 years as well, Dublin. So they're on the way up, and they have a right chance. They have a right chance, and if you're not there, you can't have a chance.
Jump back into the book. There's a lovely image where it's your brother Ollie Canning is obviously a legend of Port Tumna as well. His communion, isn't it? And the communion photo is your dad is in the club gear.
Yeah. So there's huge memories from all our family back through the years. But Ollie was probably he was the guy I kind of looked up to when I was young coming up, because born in 88, Ollie was kind of playing minor in the early 90s, 92, 93, 94, and then playing senior after that. So like all my life, I probably looked up to him. And as you were saying, going to Banisloe, going to Galway training, that's what my memories were when I was young. But Dad was a huge influence and still is on us all.
Sean.
And Sean, yeah. And he's going to matches now. Like he was only a few weeks ago, he was in Croke Park on a Saturday with my nephew Sean playing with Roscommon in a final. And then on the Sunday, he was in Turles for my other nephew Jody, who was on the Galway minor panel. So yeah, he's still involved and still going to all the games. Yeah, he's getting taxied around. There's no fear of him.
I think just talking about his childhood and growing up, and it's an interesting thing about children's books, but children want to read about other young people, you know.
Right,
so
yeah.
We get to the stories of Joe playing all the matches, but that bit about his childhood is so important in all the books. And I think the inspiration for me for this series is this book's called Ultimate Football Heroes, which most people with kids will know. They're very popular. They tell the story of Ronaldo and Messi and Mo Salah and all the rest of them and superstars, and they're brilliant books. But the idea for me was how about writing books about our own Irish sports stars? And I love that, you know, Ronaldo's childhood and Mo Salah's childhood is not going to mean that much to someone from the country in Ireland. But when you hear Joe, you know, poking the slitter and the sheepdog running after it, or
Ross,
you know, and the communion and just those stories and the fields.
The
Irishness of it, yeah. And but also to inspire kids that, like, this can be me. Like, I'm from here. I'm from this village, this place, and I can become a sporting superstar as well. It's not to make it look like this is something that's far off and distant, that you can do it.
And there's nice history too, because you even talk about Joe's parents meeting at a dance in 1964, I think it is. So all those kind of nice touches are there, and the kids love reading about the family. What's different about writing for the kind of reluctant readers, because you're in association with Dyslexia Ireland as well?
Yeah, so that was something that was really important from the start, the outset. That was the whole idea of the series. And so one in 10 children will have dyslexia in Ireland. So like that would be 3 in every classroom. So it's a lot more common than people might imagine. And, you know, often kids can kind of struggle in school. But I think over the years, we've realised that it's just that their brains work a little bit differently. They see things a little bit differently. And one of the big things is, if they're very interested in the topic that they're reading about, they'll make the effort to read an awful lot more.
Yeah.
And the research shows that at the moment in Ireland, young boys just aren't reading as much as young girls. And there's a lot of books out there. I mean, look, everyone can read any book they want, but they're kind of marketed and to appeal to young girls. And the idea was, I suppose, to fill a little gap in the market, to have books about our Irish sports stars for young people in Ireland who love sport, and to hopefully get their love of sports to give them a love of reading for the rest of their lives. Like, practically, it means very short, sharp, simple sentences, not too complicated ideas.
I love that.
And it's very, like, when we work in here in RTE, like, that's how we write for broadcast, as you well know, Oliver. And it's just, it's clear. And, you know, they always say, when you're on, you know, my main job is working on 6 o'clock news, that, you know, we like to think everyone's watching with great attention, but often they're making the dinner or they're giving it to the kids or doing something else.
Right.
And if they miss what you've said, you've no chance of coming back. You know, where you're reading a book, you can read the paragraph again. So it's a little bit like that, short, sharp sentences. And then there's a lot of work about how it's laid out on the page as well, the font and the size of the spacing and the paragraphs and things like that. And what's been lovely for me in the whole series is that I've got messages from parents saying that their young child, 9, 10-year-old, has read a book from cover to cover for the first time, and it's one of my books. And people were screaming out for more of them. So I'm delighted that Joe has come on board. Who better than Joe to have the next one? You know?
And who else was in the series? Mentioned.
So we started with Johnny Sexton, Go Johnny Go, and then King Henry Shefflin. We did Josh the Flyer then, about Josh van der Fleer. And last year we did Ireland's Call, which was the story of the Irish rugby team winning the Six Nations, which is a little bit different. And now we have Joe. Yeah.
Will it continue?
I hope so. Yeah, I have a long list of people I would love to. I'm very conscious that we haven't done any women's sports stars yet.
I didn't want to say.
that's not for the want of trying, but I have huge admiration for Katie Taylor. I'm going to New York now in a couple of weeks for her next fight for work. And I've covered Katie's career really from the start. And she's probably my number one. And it's not for the want of trying, but her story is just so fantastic. And
yeah.
I have a 7-year-old girl, and she tells me she wants, she gives it to me in the neck more than anyone else about not having written a book about a woman's sports. sports star, yeah. But she wants me to do Katie Taylor, and she wants the cover to be purple. So I hope if Katie's listening from the States, you know, she might.
That's decided already.
Yeah. So
you have a little girl, but not reading, obviously, yet. Very young.
Not yet. Yeah, she was only one there about 2 weeks ago. Yeah, Josie. So yeah, she's flying. She's getting ready now. She's a flower girl for my niece's wedding, actually, on Friday. Yeah, so we were practicing the little walk and stuff like that. She's nearly walking.
Good
luck, she's a little stroller, so she's hopefully she won't bounce into something going up the aisle on Friday now. But yeah, she's getting her own little characteristics now. She's great.
And Mammy Megan, Meg.
Yeah, Meg. Yeah,
she's a Limerick woman.
She's a Limerick woman. Yeah, born and bred in Limerick, with one side kind of Galway grandparents as well. So that's I was welcomed in a little bit easier that way. So yeah, she's good. Yeah.
Does that mean that Josie is a Limerick girl?
My dad put it well, I think the first day he said half a Limerick lady and half a Galway girl.
That's
the way it is. Yeah, she'll be growing up, I think, in Mona Lean, playing with Mona Lean and Castle Troy there in Limerick. Yeah. So another few years before she gets training, but we'll give it a go.
I'm sure you've started on that already.
Yeah, she has her little Hurlogue and everything at home, so she's more biting it and baiting stuff with it.
You're pretending you're training her for flower girl, but
yeah,
actually
it's a bit of camogie going there now. Yeah,
hang a tractor tire out the back. Yeah. Any minute now. Yeah. What's lovely is that Josie's named after your late mum.
Yeah, Josephine. Yeah, so I was obviously named after Mam as well.
Because you were the baby. And what was the gap between you and the next?
There's seven between me and Ivan. So I was it took a while for me to come along.
19 years between the oldest.
Yeah, me and Seamus. Yeah, 19 years. So like, I'd have nephews and nieces that are obviously getting married at this stage. Some of them in their 30s already. I was 5 and I was an uncle. So it's a bit mad. But yeah, there's 18 grandchildren there now as well. So big family. So it's a big weekend in our household now. But yeah, Josie is a derivative, obviously, from Mam. So yeah, it's a nice memory. And yeah, it's great.
Because you told that story so beautifully in your memoir, and it's here in the kids' book as well, which I think was a really nice thing to do, because you need to tell kids the story of reality too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's something I think we shy away from with children sometimes, but actually they're very well able to handle it. So, and in fairness, I mean, Joe's memoir, as you call it there, that he did with Vincent Hogan last year, is a fantastic book, and so well written. And he has a beautiful story, which he might tell himself, about the butterfly landing at his wedding. But it was a lovely way for me to tell that story to children as well, you know. So
what kind of butterfly was?
It was unusual. Like, the end of November, we got married in Limerick, and the priest, Father Tommy, was just talking about Mam in the sermon, and next thing, this butterfly was out the back of the altar, like flying around. And
in November,
yeah. And then we went through with Josie with IVF and stuff, and all the way through the kind of injection period and stuff like that for the couple of weeks when Meg was going through that. There was a butterfly in our house for the full time. And then when we were positive with pregnancies, the butterfly just left the house, which was, it's mad. People get those kind of like feathers and stuff, and robins and butterflies and stuff, different things. But yeah, the butterfly is kind of, maybe Mam kind of being around a lot of the time with us. So it's a really nice remembrance, I suppose, and something to have with us. But yeah, the end of November is an unusual time to see a butterfly in Ireland. So it definitely was a sign.
That'll put the tingles up anyway.
Yeah, wouldn't it? Yeah, it's a bit weird, but it's a good weird.
It was just lovely that she got to see you win in All-Ireland. Because you were really close to your mum, wasn't she? Brought you everywhere.
Oh yeah, she brought me everywhere, because I was obviously the youngest and stuff like that. Like, even going to like school, for instance, national school, brought me every morning, collected me most days. The odd day she forgot about me. I must have been bold or something. A walk home, the 3 miles, God forbid. But yeah, all the way through school as well, going into secondary school in Portumna, brought me. She was a public health nurse, so the kind of times in the morning and the evening kind of suited. So I was very close to Mam, and obviously being named after and stuff like that. Yeah, miss her every day. But she was a brilliant mother.
Becoming a parent yourself must be kind of then quite a moment when you've gone through that.
Oh, totally, yeah.
So lately.
And especially because we didn't know what we were having through IVF and stuff like that. We were very, very lucky and very blessed to have Josie, and then to name Josie after Mam was really special. It worked out really well. And,
very nice. And, you have a busy household as well, Paul.
I certainly do, yeah. Yeah, I have Ellen, who's 7, and little Brendan, who's 2.5. So, yeah, full of beans.
There aren't many Brendans, are there, in the modern world?
Yeah, it's funny. So he's named after my dad. Yeah. And, yeah, it seems like a very normal name to me. I have an uncle Brendan as well. But actually, now people say it to me, they find it amusing, but they find it unusual. And, someone said to me, it's a very important name. Sounds like he might be the president.
which I thought was quite funny.
And actually, when we were in Hollis Street and after he was born and the nurse was going around, and she said, "Oh, what did you call him?" And we said, "Brendan." And he said, the nurse said, "Oh, thanks be to God." She said, "I love hearing the old fashioned names. You hear all sorts of crazy names."
But they're all coming back. They're all coming back. I think the old fashioned names. Yeah.
It's old. It's cool. Is that what you're
saying? Yeah, it's cool now. It's trendy now. Yeah.
Yeah, but like Josie as well.
Josie's an old fashioned name.
But the reasons are very similar because this is your late dad.
Yeah. So my dad, Brendan, who was from Oi in Cork, and he died when I was young. I was 7 when he died. He had a massive heart attack and died very suddenly. So it was like he's obviously always been with me along the way. So it was nice for me to remember. We hadn't planned it. But like that, when he was born and we kind of looked at him and he felt like a Brendan, you know?
Yeah,
so,
is that right? You didn't plan it?
Yeah, very good. Yeah.
We should mention the mum, of course, who's Mary Regan. Well known, late of this place, now gone to, she's the first group political editor of the Irish Independent. That's what I mean about a very busy household.
Yeah, well, for sure. Yeah. So, yeah, Mary, people would know from 6 o'clock News, a political correspondent here in RT, has just moved to the Independent now. So she's finding her feet there. Yeah, a little bit of a juggle at home, trying to get used to the new schedule and that, you know. But look, we're great. We've good help around. My mum is around because I'm from Dublin and Mary's parents in Galway, but they come up to Dublin as often as they can. And yeah, we've got help, and you know, sure we juggle. It's a juggle for everyone, isn't it? As Joe is now discovering, you know. Yeah, but it's just trying to find the time, trying to enjoy it as well as while you can.
You could have become such an Instagram couple, you know, to telly people, to media people, going out since 1999. Joe, I was there, and it was Halloween night. Yeah, Temple Theatre.
People might wonder why we have a 2-year-old if we're having each other since then. That's a different story.
But of course, the most important thing to mention is the Liffey Swim victory. You know, as you sit next to a 5-time
monster. I've dined well out of this one. Yeah.
When was that again?
2018. So a bit like Joe said, 2017. It's like I like to pretend it was only a couple of years ago, but as the years go by, it gets a little bit further and further away all the time. You know? But I've been swimming since I was a kid, and I've been doing the Liffey since I was 14. And it's such a Dublin institution, and you get met with kind of admiration and disgust 50-50 from people thinking, what are you doing going in there? But I've always loved it. It's a great day out anyway. You always dream of winning it, but you don't ever think you will. Like, so for that to happen for me was an absolute dream.
What time of the year is that again?
It's in September. It's in September.
Have you done it since then? Have you continued doing it?
Oh, I've done it pretty much every year. I mean, the odd time maybe for work I'm away or stuff like that, but I've done, it's always circled in the calendar pretty early in the year, you know.
How did you do last year?
Yeah, oh God, I'm going to say I was top 50, but that may not actually be true. It's a handicap race, so there's always an element of it's a bit like the Grand National, you know, so you kind of hope your number's up, but you never really know. But if you have a good handicap, you know, I mean, the year I won, I knew I had a chance, but you only ever have a chance, you know. You still have to go and win it, like, you know. So it's great, but it's lovely beyond the race. It's just to you get a different perspective on the city, you know, swimming under O'Connell Bridge.
That's very true.
You know, they talk about the dark arts in the scrum and rugby, but the dark arts under O'Connell Bridge and the Liffey.
Do you see anything when you're swimming?
It's pitch black. About halfway through, it's pitch black. Yeah, so you can gain a few places or lose a few places in there. But it's a brilliant tradition, and it is.
But you get the print, don't you, of Jappy Yeats's painting, which is in the National Gallery.
Yeah, the prize. That's the prize. I've always wanted it, and now it's pride of place in my hall when you come in the front door. So the painting is there.
He wins, and he has no regrets on any of the bad days. See, Joe,
biggest
thing he's learned.
Between me and
biggest
Joe,
achievement ever.
Yeah, I'll dine out in a few years. Joe's worried about the one he didn't win. You know?
The text is saying, "We'll always be grateful, Joe, and the whole team for 2017. Years of heartbreak followed by jubilation. Good on my Agath from a Galway girl with a Daisha Mammy." Oh, that was a tough day. I'm Kilkenny to the core. Without exception, Joe was the best complete and fair athlete in the game of hurling. Apart from his natural ability and strength, he worked hard on his craft. Thanks, Joe. You were the best. One of the cats. He doesn't believe it.
No, he literally does not believe it.
And someone says, "I love the name Brendan. It is soft, so soft sounding and gentle. lots of other compliments besides. But the important thing is Joe the Great is out tomorrow, is it, in bookshops?
Yeah.
By Paul O'Flynn. Somebody's saying it's like Joe Canning has written a second autobiography inside 12 months.
But
technically you told the story.
Told
the story. And it is good fun. And I defy anyone to pick up the first chapter and not continue reading. Gill Books are the publishers. But Paul O'Flynn, thanks so much. And Joe Canning, good luck.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Now, you're very welcome back. The Rocky Horror Picture Show returns to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre from the 11th of August, and it stars Jason Donovan and Jennifer Zamparelli, who is in studio live here. Welcome, Jennifer.
How are you?
Very well. You keeping good?
I'm keeping good. The last time we met was at the Bord Gáis. We went to see Dr. Strangelove.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I was sitting next to you and your lovely partner, and I did comment on how dapper.
He looked. Mr. Lannan was commenting on this last night, says, "No, she complimented my lovely leather jacket."
Yeah, you can do better, but he looked pretty.
Said that he was the star of this interaction, basically, I think was the whole point of it.
But yes, so that was Bord Gáis, and I'm back, not as a punter, but playing the narrator in the Rocky.
You wasn't checking it out that night, were you?
It's quite a scary thing when you know you're going to do a show like that and then you're sitting in the audience and you're thinking, oh God, I have to get up there and do something. I'm playing the narrator. Jason Donovan is starring. The dates are, as you said, the 11th to the 16th of August. I have to say that, otherwise I'd be killed.
This is what you were told.
This is what I was told to say. Okay. And do you know what? I'm terrified and excited all at the same time.
But you've done this before, haven't you?
Not really.
And you started in theatre, where I'm told.
I did. I did a bit of theatre back in the day, and that's my first love. And my first memory of theatre is really when I was 7 years of age, the Balldoyle Musical Society were doing a show and they were allowing kids to partake.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is my moment. This is my big moment. And my mother wouldn't let me do it because I had my Holy Communion on one of the Saturdays.
All right.
So I was...
What would that have done to the communion? What was their
point? Well, I would have been up late and then getting up early for the communion. And she was like, it's too much. And I remember being absolutely devastated.
And your mum is involved in theatre?
Oh, yeah. She's big in the Amdram world. She... does the All-Ireland competition, with the plays.
I would have thought she'd be shoving you up there.
No, she wasn't shoving me up there.
She was a stage blocker.
She's no Kris Jenner, unfortunately. She's a bit of a stage blocker. And I remember being absolutely devastated. But I always loved it. And I always kind of dabbled a little bit. And sure, I met my husband in theatre in Bristol. I was directing a play. I had a little theatre company over there. And he was in one of the plays. And my mother... this is how much she loves theatre. I remember her saying to me, he's very good. And I was like, yeah, he's very good. And I kind of fancy him. She goes, please don't go near him because you won't be able to. If it goes wrong and then you want to do more plays, you'll just ruin it. So she gives terrible life advice and she's a stage blocker.
And you ignore her by the sounds of it.
I do. I don't listen.
When you go on stage again, it's kind of one in the eye for your mum.
So. Absolutely. I'll be sticking the fingers up at her when I'm taking the bow.
What a lovely, lovely family dynamic that is.
Yeah,
you were previously on the same stage.
Yeah.
Also with Jason Donovan.
That's right. I played his wife in Priscilla.
Stalkery kind of thing.
A little bit creepy. Yeah. A little bit creepy. He was my childhood crush when I was a teenager because I used to mitch off school and go watch Neighbours at 1:30 in the middle of the day. And then I got the opportunity to be in Priscilla, which was amazing. Now, that's a bit different because it's more of a character actor. I played his wife. I had to kiss him. I did.
How many times did you get to kiss him?
Just the once, but over a course of a week, so that's 7 kisses. Or did we do 8 shows? I can't remember.
Surely in the rehearsals, you were going, right, we have to do the snog.
Let's do it.
But
Let's
you don't
do
know any
it.
Of the lines.
Yeah, I know. So that was amazing. And I suppose Stephen Falloon, the artistic director of the Bord Gáis, always knew I wanted to go back and do something. So when this opportunity came up.
Right.
I was asked and I was like, absolutely.
What's the gap between you scoring Jason Donovan on stage and this new foray?
I don't think there's an opportunity for the narrator to lob the gob on Frankenfurter. I don't think
That's
so.
A shame.
But, we still live in hope.
12 years. It's actually 2013, apparently, was the last.
Was it?
Was the Priscilla Queen of the Desert.
Wow. Yeah. So it's been a long time. So it is a scary thing. But the reason I got involved in it, it's such a fun, sexy provocative show. It's one of those shows that kind of anybody can go and see. So those yeah. people who are not really into theatre that just want a good night out, this is the one for them. And it has the time warp.
It has this song, which will...
Oh, go on.
It's in my head, so I'm going to share it with everybody else here. This
It's just a jump to here. The left. Your hands on your hips.
You're bringing me to your crime. Where is the velvet crust? It really does feel insane. Let's do the time warp again.
And again.
Let's do the time warp again.
And again and again.
He's in suspenders for, I don't know how I'm going to be able to, you know, keep his
Jason
face.
Donovan.
Yes, yes, yes. And it's a very, like I said, it's a very sexy show. You're more than welcome to dress up if you want, you know.
And they do.
Audience, they you do. Know, they do
this
come along to the show.
This is a legendary thing. Do you know much about the history or the background to this?
I do know there's a lot of shouting at the narrator, probably why I got the role. They're like, she'll be well used to that.
And the shouting is because people go to this endlessly. It was a film, Richard O'Brien, the Crystal Maze guy,
right.
wrote it and starred in it. Was he the narrator actually in it?
No, he played someone else.
Yeah, Frankenfurter maybe.
No, he didn't play someone Frankenfurter. Else, okay. It'll come
and
to me now.
This ran in cinemas in Dublin. I think it was in Rathmines for years and years. And people would go every single Friday night. Mm-hmm. The Kenilworth's old cinema down there and threw things at the screen.
Great. Now I'm really nervous. Are people going to throw things
at
me?
But the Bord Gáis is a posh theatre. So I don't think Mr. Falloon, the Herr Director of the mm-hmm. place, would allow people to bring, like, for example, there's toast throwing in the old days.
Well, listen, if it means you're going to have a better night, I'm all up for it. Like, whatever you're into, anything goes, I think, with this show. So, whatever.
She got the date right, but no, don't bring toast.
The date right.
And come here, the narrator, you have the most interaction with the crowd.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's about three or four scenes and I get to be involved in the time warp. I actually get to do that. It's just a step to the left and that is just so exciting. And it's one of those things where you're with this crowd who have been touring the show for a very long time.
Oh, yeah.
They're all West End actors. So you don't want to look like a complete fool in front of them. So a lot of work has to be done, Oliver, you know, in the next couple of weeks because you don't want to stand out.
Okay. Have you done rehearsal?
I fly to London next week.
Oh, do you? Okay.
To rehearse, yeah.
Because it's a lot of work, isn't it, to fly over there?
Yeah. But it's great because I get to, you know, get away from the kids. And my mother-in-law is actually coming over to mind the kids.
Yeah. Your Italian mother-in-law?
No, well, she's actually from Bristol.
Oh, is she? Okay.
Yes, so she's the English side. But I think I might pretend it's a 5-day rehearsal instead of a 2-day rehearsal because, you know, she's
in
the house for a very long time.
So you're just having brunch.
Nothing against the mother-in-law. She is amazing. We love the mother-in-law. But, you know, it's a long time. It's a long time to spend with the mother-in-law.
So you're leaving the country.
I'm going to leave the country. Yeah, for more than I said. Yeah.
I thought it was in it because your husband is Italian.
Yes, his father is Italian and he spent a lot of time in Italy. And if you ask Leo, where is he from? He will say Italian first, Irish second. And
he
won't even mention, you know, he's English.
He's a stunt man.
He's a stunt coordinator and stuntman. Yeah, yeah.
Does he do very dangerous things?
He does very dangerous things, but now he kind of tells other people to do the dangerous things.
Oh, gosh,
so
right.
We don't mind that at all.
That's how life evolves as a stuntman, I presume.
Yeah, but he's home for the week and he goes back to Pinewood Studios, which is a massive studio
of course,
in
yeah.
the UK.
All the Bond films.
All the Bond films, yeah, and he's working on Star Wars at the moment. So
Star Wars?
Yeah.
Are you serious? Wow.
So it's kind of a childhood dream of his to be in a production like that. So I was like, you know, if you get a chance to bring home the Stormtrooper outfit, please do.
Yeah. Have you seen the carry-on restrictions?
You'll never be able to do it. But yeah, so he's very busy. And I suppose that was one of the reasons why I left radio is because, you
That's
know.
That's right, you did say this. Yeah.
He travels quite a bit traveling. For his work. Okay. Yeah.
So you were like a single parent at home trying to present a very long radio show. On 2FM and it's just
but also, I'm over 40, so I have to take an obscene amount of creatine. I have to walk 10,000 steps a day. I have to take 65 supplements and I have to lift weights. So
is that
it's very
how you look
busy.
So good?
No, that's why I had to give up my full-time job because it's very busy being over 40 now because we have to do so much other stuff.
I didn't, over 40 is difficult.
It's tricky.
Yeah. Does it stop at 50, do you think?
I think it just keeps going.
Just like let ourselves go at that stage.
Yeah, it's hard work.
I'm hoping for it anyway. The knees are already gone.
Are they gone?
So I'd be just kind of like, well, there's no point in doing exercise now. Do you know, it's just like, let me just melt into the sofa here.
Or into the chair.
There's a big problem with kids taking creatine because it's not very good for teenagers. Do you take that?
Well, I'm not a teenager, so I think I'm okay.
And it kind of, what does it do? Builds muscle?
It helps build muscle and it's good for cognitive, you know,
cognitive abilities to come
like,
up
I'm full. I'm full in perimenopause. I'm forgetting my words mid-sentence. And where am I? Is this not too... Where am I? I'm quite gullible. If a trainer, someone who's doing my facial, anybody tells me that this is going to help you perform, look younger, I'm buying it.
All right, so into the old creatine.
Yeah, bet into it.
Well, it's working. Something's working. You look fantastic.
Oh, listen.
And I'm not putting a condition for your age or anything because that's kind of what they do in the media. And they go, she looks amazing for her age.
For 45, yeah.
You look great.
Thank you.
And you're still very busy. Oh, Liveline, by the way, you said you were not going to rule yourself out. You'd be mad to rule yourself out of doing Liveline post Joe. What's your view now?
My view is nobody can take over from Joe.
We're not asking you that. We're asking, will you or your representatives be expressing an interest?
Absolutely not.
No interest.
No interest. Okay, no.
That job's done. No. The presidency is also going to be vacant soon.
I'm definitely going to go for that.
Are you going to go for that?
Ah, yeah. Why not?
Are you going to do county council route or seek a nomination through a party?
I haven't decided yet. You know, I think I need to brush up on my Irish. But I think, personally, I would love to see Linda Martin get it. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, Linda announced on this show and hasn't done anything about it since. But nobody else has. It's very
You'd be very good.
Why does nobody want to be the president? I'd be a terrible president.
Why?
So bored in the big house. You know, as the first citizen, you'd ask the government permission to leave the country. I'd be sneaking out all the time.
I'm
showing up doing mad speeches.
At the moment, yeah.
I'd be useless. You have to be over 35, of course, is the main thing as well. Okay, you're not going to do that. But you do have, is it hair salons is your main business?
Yeah, I have. Well, I co-own a hair salon with Bea, who is just a phenomenal woman who came to me in lockdown with a business plan that I just couldn't say no to. And it's been open 3 years. It's on Adelaide Road. It's doing very well. And we try and focus on being as sustainable as possible. So we have biodegradable towels, we have special faucets in the water, you know, to use less water. And we try and do our best without sacrificing the client's experience. So it's been a journey. This was really her thing. It's been an eye opener for me, but it's been brilliant. And I suppose business has always been very important to me. You know, working in media, you always kind of want to have a backup. You know?
Yeah. Yes. Diversify your interests.
Diversify if, you know, things aren't going.
I didn't know you were a climate action person.
Well, I wouldn't say so. I'd say my business partner is more so.
Oh, I see.
But this has been
a
journey.
You hate the environment.
Oh, I hate it. Yeah. Bring it. I love the good weather, you see.
But is that busy? Does it take up a lot of your time?
It does and it doesn't. Not really. Like, I'm not in there sweeping up hair, you know. But, you know, there are times where I'm needed and I suppose promotion and talking about it. And at the beginning, it was very, very busy. But it's lovely to have that, you know, and to keep my feet on the ground, so to speak, and to know that that'll always be there. But I've always kind of done that, Oliver. I've always kind of had businesses.
Yeah.
You know, when I left The Apprentice, I came back to Dublin and I opened up a photographic studio.
I remember that.
I was kind of running out my lunch break and doing Vox Pops for Republic of Telly and going back to work. And I always kind of had businesses or something kind of running in the background. And that always gave me that security to
just
work in
something.
Telly. Yeah, because this country is too small.
It sounds like acting is the thing you really loved the most.
Well, it is, but it's scary and it's exciting and it's something that I want to do more. I did a short film in Wexford. Actually around my 45th birthday, it was in April. And the script came to me probably the week I left radio. And it was a phenomenal script, but quite scary and daunting. It was way out of my comfort zone. It was something that I'd never, it was a very serious piece and dealt with subjects that were quite harrowing. And honestly, I didn't know if I was going to be able to do it. But I'm kind of at a stage in my life where I want to do stuff that is a little bit scary, is a little bit out of my comfort zone. Okay. Hence, I'm doing the Rocky Horror Show. And I said yes to this. And it didn't materialize till a year later. And I did it. And as scary as it was and upsetting as it was to film, it was one of the best experiences ever. So I'm excited to do projects like this. And when I was working in radio, I never really had the time or the brain space to even consider doing other pieces like that, you know?
This is because you're, assume related to your ambassadorship of the Cool Mind Drug Rehabilitation Centre. Yeah. Did that come out of something you did on the radio or where did that come from?
That was crazy. I had a podcast with Lottie Ryan about parenting.
Yeah.
And an avid fan of the podcast kept messaging me saying, I'm working with this place called Cool Mind. I would love you to come out and see it. And I never had the time or the brain space to pop out. I remember one rainy October afternoon, I went out to Ashley House, which is part of the Cool Mind therapeutic community. And I went out and I met the residents there. And I was in this place where women go to seek, seek help. And the one thing that struck me about this is there was a creche, there was child minding facilities. So these women would go and they'd go off and do their therapy, but their children were there and they could sleep with their kids and they could see their kids. Because, you know, I suspect if I was in the depths of addiction and if I had children, I would be reluctant to pick up the phone because I'd be like, are my kids going to be taken off me? Right. Am I going to see them? Because, you know, rehabilitation takes a long time, a year, 14 months, 2 years, whatever it is. So this is the only place in Ireland that provide that service.
Right.
So I got involved. It's been quite an amazing experience to be very hands-on in that ambassadorship. Mm-hmm. I went to their graduation in the Dreacht quite recently and see all these people stand up on stage and talk about their journey and what Ashley House has done for them and Cool Mind. And I just thought it's just a phenomenal place. So they asked me to run the mini marathon for them.
Right, okay.
Now that's a big thing.
They're asking a lot.
I am not a runner and that was huge. But to be able to do that, and we've lots of stuff planned for the rest of the year, it's good to do stuff like that. And it makes me feel really good and I'm very proud of what they do and I'm very much involved. And I hope even if I talk about it here or wherever I talk about it, like if people need help, they will seek help and people will support a place like that, which is much needed.
You do seem to have kept yourself very busy post radio, and you're able to juggle that with the kids and everything.
And take the creatine.
And take the creatine, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I did nothing initially. My friend Norma Sheen said to me, don't be an idiot now and book an online course or become a yoga teacher. Just stop. Because I think as women, we feel that we just have to have, we need to be doing all things
all the time.
We must be busy.
Were your kids delighted when you?
Their reaction was quite surprising because I've been in radio for 10 years and I've always worked in telly and radio since they were alive. So I said to my daughter, Florence, who was 10, I said, I have some great news. And she was like, what's the news? I was like, I'm not going to be on radio anymore. I'm going to be at home to mind you. I'll be here in the morning. She was like, are you serious? She goes, oh my God, you're not going to be on the radio anymore. She was so disappointed. It was like, oh my God, did I make the right decision? I don't know. And you just can't win with kids. You absolutely can't.
Delighted and now...
I miss it. I miss being on air. Right. I miss the interaction with people. I miss the crack. I miss my team. But do I have any regrets? I don't think so, because I've been able to do so much other stuff like the Rocky Horror Show and this film and being a decent ambassador to Cool Mind and other stuff down the line.
But the gaps might come up every now and again in radio and you would, I'm sure, not rule it out.
They might.
Dancing with the Stars definitely coming back.
I don't get that call because I have such a big mouth and I tell everybody and then...
Oh, I thought it was done and ready.
Is it? No,
is it?
Do you know something I don't know?
No, I just assumed.
I don't.
Every year it's like, is it coming back? It always does, doesn't it?
There's always issues.
You don't know right now.
As my mother says, are there any more celebrities left in the country? I was like, of course there are. There's always new ones. There's sports people. Of course there are.
Start from scratch. Bring the original ones back
in. And she's never come to see me on Dancing with the Stars.
Really? Oh, your mum is
in
coming across very poorly.
All the years. She's getting an awful bash. And she also
said... She's a lovely woman and is very, very supportive of your career. There you go. There's the lawyers happy.
Yeah. She also told me to tell a production company who were doing a documentary about my wedding And they said, well, would your mother come and help you pick the dress? And I went to my mother and I said, would you, this is a big moment. Will you come on the show? And she said, tell them I'm dead. I said, I'm not. Maybe I'll just tell them you're on holiday. That's the extent. Oh, she doesn't want to spend time with me. No, she doesn't want to be in front of the camera.
Crack. She sounds great. she should be in front of the camera.
She should. She should.
An Amdram mum who has all these.
Yeah, I thought she was done. And then we went to see The Cave in the Abbey, which is phenomenal.
Oh,
by
yeah.
The way. Really amazing.
Kevin Barry's new.
Kevin Barry's new play. Yeah. Tommy Tiernan is in it and he's excellent, but the whole ensemble were phenomenal. And she just mentioned in passing she's going back out on the circuit with another play with Clontarf players. I have to give her a little plug. Brilliant. She's going back out. But it's such a small world because we were sitting next to this man who turned to my mother and was like, are you enjoying the play? And she was like, I am. Are you? And she was like, I recognize your voice. She goes, were you on Joe Duffy this morning? He was like, I was. She goes, he said, I was on Joe Duffy talking about my late wife and I was saying I was coming to the play tonight. And my mum was like, I heard you. You were great. What's your name again? Ireland is just so small. It was one of those mad moments.
This little town we live in.
It was crazy. Country. But yeah, there we go.
Since you've left 2FM and all of that, are the trolls quieter on you? Are they easier? Are they easier on you? Have they disappeared and moved on to someone else?
Yeah, I suppose they pop up every now and then. You know what I mean? And I think over the years, I've learned to just ignore them. And I never really thought, I don't actually get trolled that much. But I looked at my Instagram and I had blocked like 20 odd people. Really? So it definitely happens. But I think I try and back away from it and hide from it and... Because it does you no good to look at stuff like that. No,
it's tiring.
It's exhausting and it's frustrating because there's very little you can do, you know. And some people get it really bad. And just because you're in the public eye, I don't think anybody deserves that kind of abuse or treatment. No. And as Nicky Byrne always said, he said, if somebody wrote you a letter with those things, you would go to the guards or whatever.
True.
But you can't do much about it online at the moment. Yeah.
At the moment. Some people do. Did you feel it was kind of a level of trolling when there were headlines and reviews every so often about yourself and Dirren and the chemistry or lack of on Dancing with the Stars?
Well, I hate her. So it was kind of true. You know, we don't get on. I'm so happy.
Wilting chemistry was the headline of the Irish Times.
Well, if they thought we'd wilting chemistry, well, maybe we did. Well, I didn't feel it. We actually get on so well. She's one of the easiest people to work with. Because Nicky was an absolute pain in the arse. No, she's really easy to work with. And I think if you're women in this industry, they just automatically pit you against each other. And we're so, actually, this is the sad thing about it. I'm so used to that. I'm so used to there being a perception that you automatically don't get on with this other woman you're presenting with.
Yeah.
And that is just continuous. That's always been the case. We actually did a funny video after to counteract our wilting chemistry. But I don't feel it. She doesn't feel it. But it isn't nice to see. It isn't nice to see when you're working so hard and you get on so well and there's no animosity and, you know, that is difficult to see.
And sometimes, and then, yeah, to see that big Saipan energy claim between the two of you. It's kind of disappointing. It would have been great if you said, we absolutely, yeah. If you give it a little bit of a dig, you know. Headlines
know,
are good out of interest.
Know.
You remember
Raging
yourself.
She went back. We had a pact. We were never going back to that place. She was back in 6 months.
That place being 2FM, just to catch people up on that whole thing.
Yeah.
Okay, those dates again. We better move along.
The 11th to the 16th of August. I think tickets are on sale now. There's limited tickets, so get them. Get them now.
Through BoardGotEnergyTheatre.ie to watch the wilting chemistry between Jason
Bring
Donovan
your lovely partner.
And Jennifer Zambrelli.
Tell him to wear his leather jacket.
By the way, thank you so much, Jennifer Zamparelli, for coming in to us. And good luck with it. You have to go and do rehearsals and everything. But most
five
of all,
days in London.
Enjoy those days off. 5 days. Good luck. Good luck. Back after these.
Email Oliver at RTE.ie.
And there you go. Some great chats from the past week. It is the end of the podcast as you know it. If you've interesting stories and things you think we definitely should know, pop us an email anytime at all. Oliver at RTE.ie. Have a great weekend. August Slán.